give up the mic.
And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. We are here every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern, live at 2 p.m. Eastern, and, of course, podcasts after that. Now, a couple of orders of business here before we talk about the issues we're going to talk about today. If politics is not everything to you, and it shouldn't be, there are other things in the world besides politics. Now, obviously, this is a specific show about a specific kind of political and economic and cultural approach. But there are other things in the world, as we all know. Whether or not we like it, there are children, there are husbands and wives, parents, there's death, there's illness, there's pain, there's nature, there's ecstasy, there's beauty, there's art, there's all kinds of other things, right? So if you want to hear a show where I make observations on things like that, or connections, or wonder out loud about those things, with some sort of personal storytelling thrown in, check out my other show on PRN.fm. And it's at 2 p.m. It's at 4 p.m. Sorry, 4 p.m. on Mondays. 4 p.m. on Mondays. It's Eastern time. And, of course, available by podcast after that. It's called The Turning Point. The Turning Point. Also, in relation to this show, to Occupied Territory, we have a mirror image over on Facebook. It's called Occupied Territory, and it's a page on Facebook. And there I post articles every day or two, write little essays, and get responses from people. People can post all kinds of things there, too, as well, videos or opinions or essays themselves. So that is on Occupied Territory on Facebook. Let's see. Now, where could we start? I'm presuming that a lot of people, well, first of all, as a sort of preamble, a lot of people who listen to this show, I'm in my 60s, right? And a lot of people who listen to this show are in their 50s and 60s, but people of every age listen to this show. There are people in their 20s. You know, this spans a pretty wide group of people, possibly and probably because it was originally dedicated to and tends to observe the issues and to follow the issues of the Occupy movement, which is more for and about and by young people, although it's for everyone. But the participants were and the philosophers and the actual people who had their bodies on the line at the encampments were and still are, to the extent they're involved, young people. But that is to say, the reason I bring that up is that there was a lot of argument going on here about the election this past fall. And this brings into question the whole idea of the political process itself in America and how things actually work politically. There was a huge running argument on this show and one other I do on Sirius Satellite Radio by people who consider themselves lifelong liberals or Democrats who were appalled by my complete disdain and even contempt, if not outright disgust, for almost all the Democratic candidates, especially those on a national level. And what a waste of time they were, how you would never get anything from them but grief. And, of course, it's all come true. But a lot of people are still sort of stuck. And in a way, it's hard to blame them because you've got this big, huge corporate two-party system, which is really one large corporate political party divided into a sort of Republican light and then Republican and then conservative. Republican light being the Democrats. So there was a lot of vituperation going on here this past fall. You had Obama and, you know, various senators and, you know, Biden and everybody running on one side. And then you had Romney and Ryan and everybody running on the other side. And people were pointing out to me, mostly Democrats, old-time Democrats, of which I used to be one in the old days, and liberals, people consider themselves liberals, even leftists, pointing out to me that my support, my ardent support, for Jill Stein of the Green Party, and also sometimes I would have Rocky Anderson on from the Justice Party, that it was going to undermine, as if I had that much influence, right? I only wish I did. It was going to undermine and destroy the possibility of Obama getting elected, and that would be a terrible, tragic disaster which would destroy this country if because of people like me, promoting, abandoning the Democratic Party, just one corporate wing of the larger party, then if it was for people like me who kept this up, we would ruin the country. And people were arguing with me, and I would, you know, sort of give them my arguments back about why it was a waste of time and a waste of their vote, and that they would only suffer as much, probably, if they voted for Obama as they did for if they did for Romney. Now, if you're in a particular category, if you're gay, if you're female out in the world trying to get by, do things, let's say you're in the service and you're female or you're gay, you can make an issue. I mean, if you're that's a pretty wide group of people, right? But some people clearly benefit under Democrats and not under Republicans. And maybe the key phrase here is, though, is under. Because what they're all under and what we're all under is a corporate police state. And, you know, this is no longer political jargon, as I point out frequently. You know, people have been using these phrases since, before I was born. You know, the fascist pigs, the fascist, you know, the fascist state. In the 30s, the communists would say the fascists. True, there are fascists. There were fascists. They continue to be fascists. And there's more of them in our government all the time. To use these words doesn't automatically, you know, I'm aware of the effect of language, right? It doesn't automatically make you some sort of mindless, left-wing radical robot just because you're programmed to say certain words like this. I'm talking about real fascism, real corporate police united together to make our lives in this country anything but fair, equal, and democratic. And when I use these terms, I mean them. So there was a big argument, anyhow, getting back to the point here, big argument between me and a lot of people. Probably they were older, people in their 50s and 60s, closer to my generation, who said that I shouldn't be doing this. The reality, now get this, the reality of things is that you're just an idealist and a destructive idealist at that if you start pushing a third party and a third party candidate, because it will take votes away from the lesser of two evils. This is the lesser of two evils theory. And it has been pointed out many, many times that the lesser of two evils is still evil. And if you keep choosing the lesser of two evils on a timeline as you go forward, you get deeper and deeper into evil. You just go at a slightly slower pace, but you're still going right off the cliff down into the abyss of total evil. And we see that clearly with Obama and, himself personally, and the kind of governmental structure he represents, and his whole party. Now, a lot of people who are arguing with me about he's the lesser of two evils, and some people are going so far as to be completely delusional and telling me what a good president he was. And I'd find out I was misunderstanding him, and I was pounding on him from a narrow, radical point of view. And I would find out that he is an administration. When he got in and he didn't need to run anymore, then we'd see the real Obama. Okay, now we're seeing him. He's putting in the same Wall Street hacks, the same evil corporate sons of bitches that he put in the last time, and he's just putting them straight in there. He's got John Brennan, his murderer in chief, his wartime consigliere, who he's pushing to be the head of the CIA. And he is appointing Jacob Lew, L-E-W, as his Treasury Secretary. And who is this guy? He worked for Citibank when it was as bad as it could be. You know, subprime mortgages, you name it, right? Derivatives. He was in there then. He got paid millions and millions of dollars to be an official at Citigroup. And now he's going through the Senate confirmation hearings, right? This guy. Now he spent 30 years, and he's pals with Geithner and Summers and all these people. It's all the same crew of people who are really among the rich and representatives of the rich and have no regard for anybody else. And they have no moral sense. These people are not amoral, such as, I don't even know what they are. They're not even human beings anymore. They're kind of financial commodified robots who represent the rich. And this guy, Jacob Lew, he was testifying just the other day in front of a Senate panel to see if he was acceptable. And this is all the more of a joke, too, right? Because the people in the Senate, the people who are asking him questions about whether or not, you know, he was participating in a scheme which favored the rich over the poor, you know, at Citigroup and other things that he's done, he had an investment in the Cayman Islands, this guy, as well, right? Turns out he didn't make so much money, which is even a poorer recommendation for him to be the Treasury Secretary. If you're going to get involved in an illegal, sleazy Cayman Islands investment, you know, scheme, at least make some goddamn money. If you're gonna appoint one of the bad guys to be the head of the Treasury Department, at least he should know what he's doing, right? So this guy is not only partially incompetent, he's a representative of the rich. And he's been and the people who are asking him questions, like Orrin Hatch and all these other people, you know, on the committee, these old tired hacks, you know, with their suits and their haircuts, They're all sitting there, and they're all rich themselves. So they're all questioning. The rich are questioning a representative of the rich and a rich man himself, whether or not he's suited to help the mass of American people who are not rich. You and me, mostly the middle class, and forget about the poor. So this is what's going on. And the president makes his inaugural speech. Hope, dream, participation, can't do it alone, progress, American dream, blah, 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 to the point where you either fall asleep, go into an actual dangerous coma, or want to throw a rock at the television. Because it's the same old, now you see it, now you don't crap. I mean, you know, it's the same. I used to have, my daughter used to have, when she was little, this is a big thing in the neighborhood I live in, they used to have birthday parties where you spend far too much money, and it was like competitive birthday parties. Who could give the biggest, splashiest, most entertaining birthday party? Of course, I couldn't get too involved because I was broke. But, you know, like, yeah, people hire clowns. It's a little bit like Congress and the administration. They hire clowns. They have balloons, you know, bread and circuses, right? Lots of money is spent. And it's a circus. It's a show. It's a clown show. This is no different than the kind of Senate hearing. When you see these Senate hearings, they're like badly scripted, badly acted kabuki shows or clown shows. Everybody knows in advance what's going to happen. People get to say what they want to say, so they make sure that they get reelected by their district, even if they don't believe it. I mean, if they say one word out of 1,000, these people, any one of them, the people testifying, appointed, or questioning, one word out of 1,000 that actually is sincere or useful or meaningful, it's an astounding thing. So all this stuff is happening. And I watch the so back to the point here. The people who are arguing with me about the lesser of two evils, we had to have Obama, all I can say to you is, good, now you got him. you want to see the real – we're going to see the real Obama. We're seeing him. People are being – the very night, the other night when he was making a speech – about, you know, the rights, human rights. He was talking about human rights in mostly in this country, right? The very night he was making that speech, a drone strike occurred over in Afghanistan, which killed 5 women and 5 children. And possibly one guy, some low-level Al-Qaeda operative or Taliban operative that they didn't like. 5 women, 5 children, dead. Blown to pieces so that they're probably not even identifiable by some tight-ass, amoral Air Force captain or major sitting in upstate New York at a console hitting a button to blow them up 7 or 8,000 miles away. The very night that he's standing up there making a speech about standing up for the rights of people who are downtrodden. And, you know, every time one of those missiles hits somebody... drone missile, a cruise missile, artillery from a distance, missiles launched by planes, fighter bombers, bombs dropped. Every time we kill the innocent people like that, for those 10 people, there's 1,000 people along with them who are related to them, who are friends of theirs, who have known them, who are in their extended family. 1,000 people, because of what we did the other night, who hate us forever. And some of those people, maybe young men generally, will join the very group that we're trying to, quote unquote, eliminate. You know, but Brennan said the other day, like he was, thought he was in a John Wayne movie, we're going to wipe them out. We're going to fight them to the end until we wipe them out. A theoretical, moral, political, economic, and geographic impossibility. Only somebody with religious fervor bordering on lunacy could imagine a thing like that. And he's supposed to be the head of the CIA. He will be. He is the head of the CIA. I don't know when his swearing in is. And all of these people, right? Jacob Lew, who's going to be the new Treasury Secretary because all the senators questioning him are rich themselves and want nothing better than to kiss his ass. All he had to do is drop his pants, but I guess you can't do that on C-SPAN. But meanwhile... you know, Jacob Lew, when they're asking him, sometimes they get a little huffy, right? Once in a while, you know, there's so much bad press that, and of course, there's a 9% approval rating of the Senate. One of the senators said to him the other day, they got a little irritated with him. He said, the definition of the Secretary of the Treasury is that he's supposed to oversee the finances of the United States, oversee the currency and how things get traded within the United States, you know, the stability of our finances. And one of them asked him, when you were at Citibank, you know, they wanted to find out about it. It was kind of quaint, almost touching. They were upset about his moral background. Ha ha. they are upset, right? And one of them said, Mr. Liu, you know, when you were at Citibank, weren't you upset about the way Citibank was at that moment, at the height of robbing and thieving, right? And we had to give them, what was it, a trillion? How much money did we give Citibank? $1 trillion to save them? Now, who are they that we saved? I don't know. So, aren't you concerned about the fact that they, at the very time you were at Citibank, that high up at Citibank, by the way, too, that they were actually doing these things, these predatory things, these mortgages and everything else? And he said, it's not my job to give financial or moral opinions. Basically, I'm paraphrasing. He said, it's not my job to give moral opinions, either when I was at the bank or now sitting in front of you. Oh, really? Oh, really? He's going to be the Treasury Secretary of the United States, appointed by the president, theoretically supposed to represent the mass of American people and their welfare, right? But it's not his job to have an immoral opinion. This is who we're dealing with. So for the people who were so alarmed that I was going to lose the election for Obama, obviously I didn't. And that I was more to the point, that I was pushing a third party candidate and constantly saying that you're completely wasting your energy, your time, and your money supporting the Democratic Party. Completely wasting your time. There is an entire world out there of people who aren't attached to these two parties anymore. They're called younger people, and they're wising up. You know, they weren't attached to them at the hip at the beginning, like a lot of us were. And it's complicated. You know, there once was a bigger difference between the Democrats and Republicans. Now there's hardly any difference. And as I say, there are special groups that there still is a serious difference. And you have to take that into consideration, right? If I was gay now and in the military, or just gay in general, if I was a woman and I was worried about my rights as a woman or my ability to succeed as a woman, I would certainly have to pick the Democrats over the Republicans. But in another way, and in a way to me that is more basic, a more basic foundation that affects all of us in a much deeper, longer way, the complete erosion and destruction of the constitutional protections and rights and privileges we have as Americans, you couldn't find anybody worse than President Obama. And I only mention him because he's the president right now. He is an enthusiastic destroyer of the Constitution and our basic freedoms. He is an enthusiastic destroyer of our Fourth Amendment rights, our right to privacy, Fifth Amendment, First Amendment, you name it. I suppose a lot of people would be upset about the fact that he's attacking or appears to be attacking the Second Amendment, but that's a different argument. So for the people who are still listening here, and I'll try to sum this up before I move on, this show really is no longer, it will have leftovers finally, because I'm still trying to get over this, like an alcoholic for decades is finally trying to become straight and get dry. I'm trying to get over a lifelong attachment to the Democrats over the Republicans, or to believing in any way that the Democratic Party is going to increase my ability to live a better life, or make it possible that I won't live a constantly worse life, morally, spiritually, financially, politically, and every other way in this country, right? I am trying to shed myself as rapidly as possible of that old belief that I had, because I was brought up that way. When I was brought up by people who were Roosevelt Democrats who grew up during the Depression and World War II. This is my parents' generation. And they believed in Roosevelt like he was God. And you could easily see why, for all sorts of reasons. But I'm not going to, you know, teach a history lesson here. But that's how I was brought up. And I also, when I was growing up, when I was in my 20s and 30s, this is 60s, 70s, right? Even into the 80s, there was clearly more of a difference between Democrats and Republicans. But now there's hardly any at all. And in this one particular case, the absorption of tremendous, even what I would call dictatorial power into the executive, and the complete abrogation of the rights and privileges of Congress and even of the judiciary. Basically, we're turning rapidly into into a corporate police state, and the president is turning rapidly into a dictator. Maybe 4 or 5 years from now, he will start, whoever the president is, he will start to wear probably somewhat, perhaps stylish and expensive military-looking uniforms. It's inevitable. This is what has to happen. There will be a kind of like epaulets, you know, he'll come out maybe with khaki on, you know, khaki suit, because more and more presidents surround themselves with generals, with security advisors, with military people, that kind of thing. So to all those people who are still attached, as I was, to the Democratic Party, or consider themselves an old-fashioned liberal and, in that case, attached to the Democratic Party, I think it is becoming clearer and clearer now to all those people how they have finally come to a point, or we have come to a point, where it is no longer possible to do that, where you are wasting your time, your hopes, your energies, and any money you might contribute. Time to dump the Democratic Party. And salvation for Americans, if there's to be any, as a truly equal or democratic country where people truly have equality and rights and financial equality, especially, does not reside. This the salvation here does not reside in the current political system. Voting is not going to make any difference with these people unless you vote for a third party to try to build it up. And people always say, well, be realistic. Don't be idealistic. Be realistic. No major accomplishment or step forward in the political or economic evolution of human beings, and I'll limit it to this country over the last couple of hundred years, happen through, I shouldn't say no, but almost no evolution worth anything in terms of equality, advancement, and anything else that represents that or even that resembles that, happened through the standard political system. It happened outside it. Massive demonstrations in the millions against wars or for civil rights or for women's rights or for gay rights. People had to die over these, you know, over these struggles. People had to get out in the street and get arrested in the hundreds of thousands if you finally add it up by decades. In the 30s, there were marches and demonstrations and protests and strikes in the millions, and if you adjust for inflation, in the that would be like in the 5 millions or 10 millions now if it happened now. Millions of people in the Depression saw things pretty clearly for a change, finally, how bad it could be when greed got carried away and then controlled the actual government itself. So that's where salvation has to lie, hence this whole show, Occupied Territory. If people don't go out on the street and they don't protest and they don't break laws and there is no civil disobedience and mass protests, we have had it. We're doomed. And do we see any of these mass protests now against, you know, the fascism and the dictatorship of the executive branch of the government over the laws that are passed that have nothing in them but grief and misery for the mass of us and just a few benefits and benefits only for the rich? Do we see any massive protests against wars, murders, killings, absorption of our money to create dictatorships overseas and corrupt governments and assassinate people? We don't see one damn thing. We don't see anything. One of the reasons for that probably is because there is no draft right now, but that's another discussion. So with all having said all that, how many of you saw or even bothered to watch anymore? To the people who bothered to watch and didn't do something else, like, I don't know, whatever else you choose to do in your life, right? If you watched the President's State of the Union, address, it's something I did. I guess it's a leftover. Also, I feel like it's homework that I have to do because I do political shows on this station and elsewhere. Anybody who watched that show, the main theme of the and I call it a show, right, because it's just bread and circuses. You watched Mr. Obama, the current version of the executive absorbing all executive power to himself. You watched him talk about his riding into the rescue to rescue the beleaguered and sinking middle class. Most of the speech was about rescuing, rebuilding, and restoring the great middle class in America. You know, the American dream, blah, blah, blah. The house, the car, well, you can do better than your parents did. where you're not worrying all the time, where you're in debt, where you have a decent job, et cetera, et cetera. Now, my question here is, you got a guy who has absolutely no interest whatsoever in the middle class by his behavior, by the people who are his associates, by his entire government, by the actions even of Congress, his whole party, right? He is an enemy of the middle class. That is to say, you and me. I'm assuming that most of the people listen to me are vaguely in the middle class. I know some of us now are sort of, or some people listen to me, are sort of on the edge of poverty level. Like if you're retired and you have Social Security, the cost of everything is so high now and there's so little income coming in that that a lot of people who probably are listening to me now, who mostly maybe might be elderly or retired, might be on the verge of poverty. But I think probably, let's say, 75-85% of the people listening to me right now, if you're not students or living on Social Security, are in the middle class, basically. You know, you make maybe your household income, if it's you or you and a wife or you and a husband, you make maybe anywhere between $30,000 and $40,000 and $80,000 to $100,000. Now, this president, only 6 or 7 weeks ago, made a deal with Congress. So this rich guy made a deal with the other rich guys about taxes in this country. We didn't get to deficits and costs yet. We made a deal about taxes. It was an extraordinary, shameless giveaway to rich people. He took a little pocket change out of the pockets of the rich and basically saddled the middle class with an additional 2% payroll tax, which is a lot of money. Now, you know what I'm talking about, right? You're listening to me now. And this happened on the people posted this information on the Facebook page on Occupied Territory. If you make $60,000 a year or $70,000 a year or whatever it is, or $50,000 a year, or a combined household income somewhere in there, that's a lot of money that all of a sudden is out of your paycheck. And it happened automatically. So since he's done that, in my house, we have $100 less a month coming in. When you take away taxes and the basics that you have to pay, your rent, your electricity, when you buy food, and the cost of these things is huge and immense, and it keeps going up at nothing. There's no cap on these things. I mean, God forbid that the president and Congress, as representatives of the people of the United States, would put caps on the prices of things. Cap on the price of gasoline. Make it $2. You know, so that ExxonMobil doesn't make, you know, $30 billion profit a year and not pay 1 cent of tax on that. Cap it so they make $2 billion profit a year. That's enough. They're going to still do oil research and, you know, poison the earth and the water. Don't worry about them. They'll be okay. Right. So he raised the amount of capital gains tax a little tiny bit. He lifted the income tax from 35% to 40% on 39.9% actually on people who make over $400,000 a year. They did not lift the current cap on Social Security payroll tax. So if you make $113,000 a year or up to $113,000, you pay a certain amount, you can make anything you make over that doesn't even get taxed. And how is that? In other words, the bottom line here is the president basically gave away the whole store, our store, the middle class, most of us, to the rich. I had an economist on my show on Sirius about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and she said, and she spends a lot. She works at a think tank, right? What she did was she monitors the statements in places like the Wall Street Journal and others and Forbes, and she monitors even like public emails, and she even gets leaked emails that go on between hedge fund investors and investment banks. She said that they were virtually having a party after this deal was made. She's never seen these people happier in years. Because he didn't really tax the rich at all. And he laid this tax on all of us who can ill afford it. After you pay your income tax, or they take it away from you, after you pay your rent or your mortgage, after you pay for gas in your car, presumably you're not driving all over the place like some idiot on a TV commercial, you know, in the Himalayas to see how fast you can go. You know, you're using the car for what you need to use it for, right? So after you pay off the car payments, after you pay off you know, your basics. After you buy food, after you buy clothes for the kids, after you buy new clothes because your clothes are falling apart, you've had them for 5 years, there's hardly any money left at all. If you want to save any money, maybe even if you want to buy some new kind of necessity, or if you want to buy decent food instead of junk food, you can hardly afford to do that anymore. So what's he do? He takes another $100, $120, $150 a month out of your budget. That's a lot of damn money for most of us these days with the cost of living and every other burden that's on us. So he gets up there after having done this and basically screwed the middle class. And he gets up there and he makes this passionate speech with his firm chin looking off into the distance, you know. And everybody standing up and applaud him like a bunch of rich trained seals every time he said something about saving the middle class. Here's my question. Is this man delusionally insane to say this? Or does he just think we're a bunch of idiots and won't know the difference and can't do anything about it anyhow? You choose. I'm just putting this up to you. This man has contempt for the middle class. He just looted the middle class. He just made it harder to even live if you're in the middle class. He didn't tax the people he should have taxed. He didn't impose the simplest kind of tax on these rich bastards, the 1% or the 1% of the 1%. A billion trades every day, a billion electronic trades, lightning fast electronic trades occur every day, derivatives, mortgages, bonds, stocks, a billion trades a day. A tax of 0.1% on every one of those trades, which would automatically have to go straight to, you know, would go straight to the government, would account for $50, $60 billion a year. Some people estimate it could be $100 billion a year. One or two or three simple, painless for rich people taxes would completely eliminate the necessity of taxing anybody who makes less than a few $100,000 a year, even for anything. And it would eliminate the necessity to even consider cutting Social Security or raising the retirement age. Right? And this is just, you know, one of the things I'm talking about here. And meanwhile, he's getting up and talking about the middle class and we'll all have to do our part, really. Is that right? Did you know that last year and the year before that and the year before that, General Electric, Verizon, ExxonMobil, and about four or five other huge giant companies who made profits of over $100 billion or $150 billion total in the course of 1 year, profit, paid almost no income tax. None of this, the Robin Hood tax, that's the financial transaction tax, no lifting the cap on who gets taxed on how much on Social Security, no real lift on the income tax, no real closing of loopholes, because, you know, every one of those rich people hires accountants and lawyers to figure out ways not to pay their taxes anyhow. So it won't make any difference to them. And yet he is able to stand up on national television and look around and be righteously angry and passionate about the middle class. So here's the question again. Is he actually crazy? Is he out of his mind and really believes what he's talking about? There are drugs to help him. I read there's a new sort of light sort of shock treatment that he can undergo to restore his sanity. Or does he, and this is more likely, because he's been so successful at convincing a great many people, including people who consider themselves liberals and Democrats, that he is going to save us, that he's going to actually restore equality, that he's going to fix our economy, that he's going to provide decent jobs and fix education and fix this and fix that. Has he actually convinced a lot of people who would otherwise or should know better, who are more intelligent, that he's really going to do this? Does he think that most people are just rank morons? I have to say, and I know this is a really sort of unfortunate, perhaps politically incorrect thing to say, that my observation over many decades now and having done political programs and taking calls and getting letters from thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of people over 30 years about politics and observing how people vote and how people what people turn out for and who they support, that the president has every right to assume, as do most senators and congressmen, that a majority of their electorate are moral and intellectual morons. And so he's playing to that. He's in a celebrity TV commercial avatar bullshit world, and everybody eats it up like chocolate cookies. Why should he be any different? He's going to save the middle class? He just screwed the middle class. Here's an article from the Times the other day. Mr. Engineer, how much time do I have left? Okay, thank you very much. There'll be an increase in your payroll tax because you helped me out. Here's an article from the New York Times. Let's see. Restored payroll tax pinches those who earn the least. This is not news to you, but anyhow. I don't want to read these whole articles, but and I'm bad at doing this, right, because I'd like to read the whole article so you get the drift of it. But it starts out, Jack Andrews and his wife no longer enjoy what they call date night, their once-a-month outing to the movies and a steak dinner at Logan's Roadhouse in Augusta, Georgia. In Harlem, Eddie Phillips' life insurance payment will have to wait a few more weeks. And Jessica Price is buying cheaper food near her home in Orlando, Florida, even though she worries it may not be healthy. Like millions of other Americans, they are feeling the bite from the sharp increase in payroll taxes that took effect at the beginning of January. There are growing signs that the broader economy is suffering, too. Now, get this, too, right? Here's the president who wants to the burden of his entire speech was to lift the economy, right? To stimulate the economy. This is why I'm talking about that he's either insane or that he's a con artist of the first rate, right? He keeps telling everybody, and he said it the other night, he wants to stimulate the economy. He wants to lift the economy. This thing he did by restoring the 2% payroll tax for Social Security, which could be easily funded in other ways. There's no law on what is supposed to fund the Social Security fund. Trust fund. There's no way that it's described that it has to be funded. It could come from anywhere. It could come literally as a Robin Hood kind of thing from the rich. Why not? Like millions of other Americans, these people are feeling the bite from the sharp increase in payroll taxes that took effect January, and there are growing signs that the broader economy is suffering too. Why? Because we all have less money to spend. The payroll tax he dropped on us, this son of a bitch. The payroll tax that he dropped on us means that we're going to spend less money, that tens of millions of people in the middle class, like me and the people who listen to me, are going to spend less money because they have less money. And if you spend less money, then that means less consumption. And if we're talking about a consumer society, which we live in, and that's another whole discussion, whether, you know, the value of that. But if you live in a place where you buy food, you buy products, you buy services, you buy things that are necessities. The people who work at these places are, you know, these companies and these businesses, whoever provides all this stuff, they will get less and less business. They will lay people off. They will pay less taxes because they're making less money. They will provide less service. Life will become more dismal. Fewer people will be employed. Less taxes will get paid. The economy will sink. This is a man who said he wants to grow the economy. Chain store sales have weakened over the course of the month since he started doing this. And two surveys released last week, and I shouldn't say he in Congress started doing this, suggested that consumer confidence was eroding, especially among lower income Americans. While these data points are preliminary, more detailed statistics on retail sales and other trends will not be available until later this month. At street level, the pain from the expiration of a 2 percentage point break in Social Security taxes in 2011 to 2012 is plain to see. And it goes on here to describe people who work hard, maintenance men who work 6 days a week, people who work as teachers and other people who are retired, people who are getting along on incomes between, let's say, the $25,000 and, you know, $75,000 are suffering from this and can't spend the money that they would ordinarily spend. And it's, you know, you could say, oh, well, poor Jack and Jane can't go out for their date night once a month. You know what? Life is hard for all of us, right? If we could get the smallest little connection between each other and a little bit of relief now and then from the toils and tribulations of this arduous, almost meaningless, difficult life that we all lead here in this country, where things are more expensive all the time and inequality has reached the proportions of insanity. If we get the smallest little relief from that, it goes a long way. And now that's not available to people. Let's see. The tax break, which was pushed by the White House to stimulate spending in 2011 and extended to 2012, was always supposed to be temporary. But with pressure building in Washington to reduce the deficit and politicians fighting bitterly over whether to raise taxes on the very rich, why is that a fight at all? People who are voting for either of these parties. The question of how the increase in Social Security taxes would affect the poorest workers did not seem to garner much debate on either side of the aisle. I don't see any reason to continue to consider supporting its extension, said Timothy F. Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, in testimony last year. Even Nancy Pelosi, a reliable liberal who leads the Democratic minority in the House of Representatives, was for letting it expire. Timothy Geithner and Nancy Pelosi are rich. Their friends are rich. They don't know anybody except their maids, their gardeners, and their houseboys who aren't rich. They have four cars, five houses. Nancy Pelosi, who doesn't mind letting this this break expire so that we all have to pay more payroll tax now and have less money, she and her husband have assets of $70 million. He's a goddamn banker. She does insider trading that we would get arrested for, but she gets away with it because she's a congresswoman. Timothy Geithner, this sniveling little rat, is that the hireling. He is the creature of people on Wall Street. He is rich from his connections on Wall Street. He was supposed to be, as part of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York City, overseeing what was going on. He was asleep at the wheel when the worst possible things happened to this economy. He doesn't see any problem with it. She doesn't see any problem with it. Of course they don't. Neither does the president, who is a multimillionaire, who has a chef and a personal plane, and who thinks he's God's gift to the world. Neither does most of the Congress, who have multimillion-dollar salaries and assets. The higher rate applies to all earned income up to $113,700. For a household earning $100,000 a year, the 2% percentage point increase means an additional $2,000 a year in payroll deductions. Listen to this. Economists estimate that the payroll tax increase will reduce disposable income by about $120 billion and shave half a percentage from the economic growth in the first quarter. A significant blow, given that the economy is expected to expand only 1 to 2%, et cetera. If you wanted to design a policy to squeeze the spending of the lower and middle income households, raising the payroll tax is the way to do it, said Ian Shepherd, Shepherdson, chief economist at Pantheon Macroeconomic Advisors. Oh, boy. Et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is what goes on. And so... I'm trying to wean myself all of this off of all this, you know, the politics, the MSNBC, the Democratic Party, and I'm doing very well. I have really sort of left them in the dust. When I watch Congress debate or have hearings, when I watch the president give speeches now, the times that I really do that, when I would rather be watching a hockey game or an old movie or reading a book or writing a book or rewriting a book is what I'm doing now, or hanging out with my wife or talking to my friends on the phone or talking to my kids. When the times when I watch this, and I shouldn't any because it just raises my blood pressure and makes me depressed to see this, watch these guys in their fancy suits, you know, playing games with each other, basically mutually jerking each other off and then pretending to be irritated with each other, making speeches about saving the public and representing the people of America and the American dream. These guys are the American nightmare, but they're talking about the American dream. And when I watch this stuff, and when I watch things like MSNBC, which I don't do anymore, during the run-up to the last election, I watched MSNBC because it was impossible to watch any other major television station, and I couldn't watch current TV anymore because I was a big fan of Olbermann's till the rich, greedy, you know, egomaniac decided to self-destruct over there. So there was really no television to watch about this. I could listen to radio, but I didn't. And I just basically, you know, checked on various, websites and blogs like I usually do. Or I just read the papers, made up my own mind about it because I know enough by now. Yeah, I can't. So I'm watching MSNBC. I'm off these people now. Thank God. I feel like somebody who attended NA or AA meetings successfully. And I could now say to people, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty I'm free at last from having the slightest attachment or belief or interest in what any of these people say. Now, I ordinarily, like last year or the year before, I might have watched the people at MSNBC, Maddow and, you know, Chris Matthews and all these other Democratic Party media hacks. I might have watched them analyze the president's speech. Well, first of all, I don't like to watch anybody analyzing what I just saw. I just saw it. I haven't been dropped on my head recently, and I actually can read and write, and I can think. I don't need somebody to analyze what I just saw and heard, right? So meanwhile, I don't, for that reason, I won't watch it. But The other reason is, wait a minute, how much time do I have? Is that 300 minutes? So the other reason I don't watch MSNBC is because I know if that I watch them analyze the insane delusional bullshit that this man just laid out and that all these people jumped up and applauded, except for the really old people who had to be given sedatives and stimulants, you know, the other Congress people. I know that they analyze this after watching him just say the most shameless, crazy things that he could possibly say and pulling the wool over 90% of the people's eyes in this country, that they would probably applaud him and talk about how thrilled they were for his bold initiatives and his support because he said the magic words, you know, like he said gay, he said women, he said equality. This guy's no joke. He's no joke. He knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. So I see, I'm sort of leaning to the fact that he's not actually crazy, that he actually really does believe that people are essentially morons and they will buy anything that he puts out because they do over and over again. Why should you blame these people for believing that they can say the same crap over and over again when they feel like getting elected or when they appear in public and believe that people will buy every piece of camel dung that they ladle out, that they'll lap it up? Why should you blame them for believing that? Because people do it all the time. And you watch people like Rachel Maddow and Chris Matthews and all these other people, even Ed Schultz, who I sort of like. They would get on there. And I know that for an hour they'll get on there and they'll be beaming in the reflected glory of their boy. They will say, wow, he really put his foot down. He told those Republicans, didn't he? I'm glad he said blah, 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 gay, blah, 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 women. I'm glad he told the Republicans that they are standing in the way of progress. It's all part of the same machine that is rolling over you the same way the machines in the Terminator rolled over human beings. They're just rolling over all of us. And once again, I say the only way – you want to know about Obama? I don't know how much time I have left here. I'd like to read another article. But so let me – how much time do I have? 7.5 minutes. All right. This is from my friend Greg Palast, my old pal Greg Palast. You know him? P-A-L-A-S-T. And he wrote this for Truth Out, for a place called Truth Out. And he's a terrific journalist. And this is from his book. The book is called Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, with comics, graphic illustrations by Ted Rall, who's a terrific illustrator and a real legitimate radical, right? So from the book Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, here, a parade of media reports this week named Penny Pritzker as Obama's prime choice for Secretary of Commerce. No longer will criminal bankers have to lobby the administration because now they'll have one of their own in the cabinet. We never heard of this guy, Barack Obama, until 2004. Less than 3 years before taking the presidency, he was in the Illinois State Senate, a swamp of scammers, backhanders, and party machine tools. I like the way Greg writes. Not a stellar launch pad for the White House. But then one day, State Senator Barack Obama was visited by his fairy godmother. Her name is Penny Pritzker. Pritzker's net worth is listed in Forbes as $1.8 billion, which is one hell of a heavy magic wand in the world of politics. Her wand would have been even heavier and her net worth higher, except that in 2001, the federal government fined her and her family $460 million for the predatory, deceitful, racist tactics and practices of Superior, the bank and loan shark operation she ran on the south side of Chicago. Superior was the first of the deregulated go-go banks to go bust. At the time, the costliest failure ever. U.S. taxpayers lost nearly $500 million. Superior's depositors lost millions, and poor folks in Senator Obama's Southside District lost their homes. Penny did not like paying $460 million, not one bit. What she needed was someone to give her hope and change. She hoped someone would change the banking regulators so she could get away with this crap. Pritzker introduced Obama, the neophyte state senator, to her friends on Chicago's Gold Coast. Obama got lunch, gold, and better, an introduction to Robert Rubin. Rubin is the former Secretary of the Treasury, former chairman of Goldman Sachs, and when Robert met Barry, co-chairman of Citibank. Even atheists recognize Rubin as the supreme deity of Wall Street. Rubin opened doors to the finance industry vaults for Obama And he got a lot of money for his I'm trying to skip ahead here. So what did Citibank's Rubin get for showering Obama with gold? Obama agreed to take Rubin's to take care of Rubin's poodles, Larry Summers and Tim Geithner. They became Obama's first cabinet picks. Geithner and Summers were the gents who, under Treasury Secretary Rubin, designed the deregulation of banking. In effect, they had decriminalized the kind of financial flim-flammery that brought the planet to its knees while bringing Rubin, Pritzker, and the banksters loads of cash. Rubin received more than $100 million from Citigroup, the gargantuan commercial bank investment bank casino created by deregulation. It's worth a mention that Rubin's centi-million payoff went unchallenged by Citi's new owner, the U.S. Treasury, et cetera, et cetera. Pritzker has taken this state senator community organizer from the ghetto. That's Mr. Obama, made him a U.S. senator, and then as Obama's campaign finance chairwoman, raised a mind-blowing $750 million to make him president. She's the main person behind this guy making him president. She made him president, Penny Pritzker. She and her family own the Hyatt Hotel chain and also a chain of nursing homes, in addition to having this bank, which was one of the worst banks in the country. In return, in 2008, Obama decided to make his patron, Penny Pritzker, the Secretary of Commerce. But then in November 2008, just as Obama was about to submit her nomination to Congress, a bunch of Pritzker's victims marched on Washington. They were not from her busted bank, but unhappy workers from the lucrative nursing homes that her family owns through a string of complex offshore trusts. Obama slammed the door on Penny. Hyatt Hotel and Hyatt's nursing homes routinely have one of the worst records of treatment of their workers. Their workers are enraged with them for the way they're treated. Hours, wages, benefits, part-time work when they should have full-time work. This is the person completely 100% behind Obama's being president. In the 2012 campaign, Obama, to his credit, kept the door shut on Pritzker, reducing her to hosting an election fundraiser at her Gold Coast digs. Let's see. The Pritzker family made its billions mostly from Hyatt hotels and Hyatt nursing homes. Penny, on the Hyatt board of directors, is an infamously combative anti-union apostle. Unite Here, it's called Unite Here, the union that represents Hyatt workers, has called for an international boycott of Hyatt hotels. In 2012, Unite Here and its parent, the AFL-CIO, were crucial to Obama's winning Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin. So in this last campaign, Obama had to keep his billionaire heiress on the down low. But today, with the union's money and votes already pocketed and counted, Obama can give working folks the finger and Penny her pound of flesh. The Commerce Post. The New York Times says that, quote, at Commerce, Ms. Pritzker could provide the president with a new way to reach out to the business community. I bet. Oh, man. The last time Pritzker reached out to the business community was to sell them subprime mortgage securities, worthless bags of financial feces manufactured by her bank, Superior Bank. If Penny the piggy banker gets Commerce, we'll have to drop Obama's rating to subprime. If you want to, by the way, help the people who are fighting against this pig, who's Obama's main financial backer, and maybe the R Secretary of Commerce coming up, go to a place called Hyatt, H-Y-A-T-T, Hyatt Hertz. And it's a place where you can help, maybe give some financial help or some backing to the people who are workers who are victimized by this person. So this is Obama. This is the man. This is the lesser of two evils. He's murdering people with drones. He's taken unto himself executive powers which are clearly fascist and dictatorial. He is spending billions of dollars, which is not even accounted for, our tax money in the budget, to build facilities to spy on everybody. He is prosecuting whistleblowers who are trying to reveal government corruption and government behavior, which is completely unconstitutional. He is setting his Justice Department to lock these people up. He is prosecuting Bradley Manning and approved of the torture of Bradley Manning. He has blown people up overseas with these drones, which is immoral and which is creating, every time one of those things strikes and kills a civilian, is creating thousands. Every few months, he's creating thousands of new people who want nothing else but to destroy America. He is doing all these things. He is taking unto himself fascist powers. He is screwing the middle class. He is ruining people's lives minute by minute as he's in the White House. And this is the lesser of two evils. I guess he is the lesser of two evils. Point is, we have to think outside his old, tired, corporate political media box. Think outside it. And when I'm here next week, I will be giving you a list of things, lest I just be seen as somebody who's a complainer and a critic, a list of positive ways, people, websites, blogs, and organizations, ways in which we can all, unite so that we can have a country that thrives outside of this poisonous corporate consumerist crap. And this guy Obama, don't waste your money, your time, or even one thought on thinking that he's doing anything for you. He's as bad as the rest of them, and so is the whole bunch of his crowd. We've got to be outside of this group, and that's what this show is here for. All right, that's it for this week.